thinks he has mankind in his jaws, ready for victory, that God brings him once again to humiliation and failure. And ultimately, God will do this through Jesus Christ, who through centuries and centuries has come down from the seed of Eve. Now, once God judges Satan and disciplines the man and woman so that they'll learn to depend on Him and rely on Him, then Adam trusts the promise of God, believes in the promise of God, he changes Eve's name, and then a look at verse 21. The Lord made garments of skin for Adam and his wife, and he clothed them. Where did God get the skins for Adam and Eve? By the sacrifice of animals. God sheds blood to make clothes for Adam and Eve. Those clothes were the result of sacrifice. Under your outline in C, Genesis 3:21 marks the beginning of animal sacrifices. And this, if you will, is a kind of a kindergarten of grace for Adam and Eve. God bears the pain and the agony of their sin, and He presents to them what it takes for sin to be forgiven. And they learn the lesson, because in turn, they, under your outline of number D, they turn around and they pass on this knowledge to Abel, their son. And Abel, in chapter 4 and verse 4, comes with the firstlings of his flock to give to God. And the writer of the book of Hebrews, chapter 11 and verse 4, said, "By faith Abel offered God a better sacrifice than Cain, and by faith he was commended as a righteous man. Because he came in faith, putting his faith in the provision that God had made for his sin. In the innocence of this animal here. He came in faith believing God's promise, offered the animal, and as a result became a righteous man because of the offering that was made." Harvey read this morning that God designated the life of a man be symbolized by the taking of the life of an animal. That atonement, forgiveness, was in the blood. And this is where it first gets started. God is teaching man how to deal with his sin when he transgresses, when he commits iniquity. Now, this sacrificial system goes all the way down through the book of Genesis, but we're never explained why. Isaac offers sacrifice. Jacob does. Noah does. Characters all the way down through that old Testament offering sacrifices. We're not sure of the meaning of it until you get to the time of the Exodus. God brings His people out of Egypt, brings them to Mount Sinai, and He gives them a law, 10 commandments. Here is the way you're to live. These are your values and guidelines and principles that are to govern your life. And then you know what He does? He turns right around and makes provisions for them breaking the law. What do you do, God, when you fail? What do you do when you're defeated? What do you do when you've transgressed the law? And He says, here's what you do. Here's the provision. And therefore, He sets forth the sacrificial system. And we see that especially in the book of Leviticus. And I never will forget my first exposure to the book of Leviticus. I quit after about chapter 1.5. Maybe after chapter 2. All these elaborate ceremonies, rituals, washings, and all these intricate sacrifices. And you had to wear certain clothes, and you had to be at a certain place at a certain time. And only a certain person could do certain things. And the details were so minute. And the mannerisms were described in such a strict way that I was totally puzzled and lost in the book. But once I waded through that book, there are six parts to a sacrifice. And I want to go over those with you here because it's essential for us in understanding the cross. Number one is the drawing near, or the offering of the sacrifice itself. This is where a man, let's take an average Israelite family. This man has committed a transgression. He's coveted, or he's lied, borne false witness. He goes to his flock of lambs and of sheep, and he chooses out of that flock the best he's got, an unblemished animal, an innocent lamb, something that's been domesticated. Not something that's wild, something that he's caught somewhere. Something that's basically tame. And people didn't do what we do today. We during those times, we pin up our animals and feed them, you know, lots of corn and whatever else on a good diet, and then we slaughter them and eat them. They depended on a lot of those animals for their livelihood. Sheep, for example, were used for clothes. Wool was taken from them. And they got close to those animals. They even gave them names. They lived closer to the land. They were an agrarian people. They were dependent on the land. And so a man would choose an animal that was unblemished and spotless, without disease. And then he would bring it to the altar. And the second thing he would do is he would lay his hands on the head of that animal as a gesture of identification, and he would confess his wrong and his sin. The third thing he would do by his own hand is he would slaughter the animal. Then the fourth thing would happen is the priest who was presiding there would take the blood from the animal. And according to whatever occasion it was, whether it was the Day of Atonement or whatever, the priest would take the blood and either sprinkle it before the veil between the holy and the most holy place, or he would sprinkle it on the horns of the altar, or he would put it around the base of the altar. Then the fifth thing that would happen was that there were prescribed parts that were taken. Parts of the animal, legs. Legs, the side or whatever. And sometimes that was consumed on the altar, and other times it was just burned up. Like, for example, the whole burnt offering, where a man would take a whole animal and it would be burnt up, symbolizing his total commitment to God. Paul uses that in Romans 12, 1 and 2, when he's talking to the people there about offering themselves to God as living sacrifices. He was talking about the whole burnt offering there. And then the sixth thing that would happen would be the disposal of the animal. Sometimes the priest would take it, depending on what kind of sacrifice it was. The priest would take it as payment because his livelihood depended on the operation of the temple and the tabernacle. But most of the time it would be removed from the camp and disposed of, because it was seen to be taking sin away from the people to be purged in the sight of God. So that was the sacrifice. Now, when people read the Old Testament, they're thinking, what good does those things do? What sense, what kind of sense does that make? That seems so senseless, so useless, so extreme and arbitrary. And isn't that a little below the dignity, intelligence of a supreme being, namely God, that he would get a bunch of rules and regulations and order all these kinds of things for people? Not at all. Let's look at the purpose of sacrifice, which is B under your outline, Roman numeral 2. The purpose of sacrifice, one, is that it's a form of communication that the people understood. Here I am, I'm a man, I'm an Israelite with my family, and my very livelihood depends on this group of animals. This group of animals is precious to me. My family will die unless my livestock does well. and I take the best of those animals and I bring it for my sin. What is that telling me? That God is telling me something through that. There's a symbolism there. And when I take my hands and place it on the animal, that innocent animal, what is that telling me? That that I deserve to die. That I deserve the punishment and the penalty for this sin. But here God is providing something here to take the place of me, to substitute for me. And as that animal's throat is cut and the blood runs, I'm watching this, I'm doing this. I'm seeing, secondly, the seriousness of sin. First of all, the purpose of it was to identify with man in a form that he could understand. God was communicating with man through what he could understand. And that is, he's raising animals. He's kind of like a farmer. This means something to him. And second of all, to communicate the seriousness of sin. Because here I am a man, I've taken good and evil upon myself to judge. I'm often even unaware that I'm doing anything wrong. But here's a holy God who can see the whole picture. I've told one lie. And to me, that's just a lie. But He can see the consequences of that. He can see what that lie did to whoever I told it to and how it spreads out through all the other people that were affected by that lie. And He can see what it's done to my personal integrity, how it's affected my heart and my life. And somehow, He wants me to see that as an Israelite. And so I bring this animal and I watch the blood flow and I see the seriousness of sin. The fact that an innocent life has to be taken in order for me to see the seriousness of it, the ramifications of it, the consequences of it, the problems that incur because of it. And thirdly, how else is He going to communicate His character and His holiness to a people who've been steeped in idolatry? Once He gives the instructions in Leviticus 16 and 17 about the kinds of sacrifices, then He's going to say, now, you know what the implications of this are? I want you to be holy because I'm holy. I don't want you to be like the peoples around you. Don't live like you used to live back in Egypt. And don't live like the people whose land you're going to inherit. Don't live like that. And then He goes and lists a bunch of things that they're doing. This God is holy. He's unique. And all these little intricate things that they did, even down to the manner of dress, all of them were to get them to think about the uniqueness, the holiness, the greatness, the glory, the majesty of the God that they were serving. He was not like the gods that they came from. And fourthly, they were to trust. They were to learn to trust in the provision that God gave. That was the purpose of the blood and the sacrifice. The blood itself didn't have any value. The body of an animal didn't have any value. In and of itself, it was the value that God assigned it. God said, this is, the blood is the life. It's the atonement for your sins. Trust it. Put your trust in it. It was the value that He assigned to it that made it valuable. That's why the prophets, if you go through and read prophets, that's why they got so upset. They would get sacrificed. They get the people in the room. They would just go through emotions. You know, they bring an animal in and kill it and put a blood on it. The prophet makes them so angry. It incensed them. Because the people just went through the motions. It's just a ritual ceremony being done. And then you're on receipt. These sacrifices were only temporary. Only temporary. Because behind them was a reality that was coming, the reality that we're about to talk about this morning. But these sacrifices were an annual reminder of sin. It was to remind the people that, hey, this is not permanent. because it's impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sin. The Hebrew writer says in chapter 10, verse 3, the animal sacrifices served only as a shadow. Behind the shadow stood the reality. They only served as a type. They only served as a symbol. The real thing is coming. And God wanted them to see that by the repetition of these sacrifices over and over and over again, that they weren't sufficient. They weren't adequate. That something more personal has to come. And come it did. Those living by faith in the promise of God could see the reality on the horizon. That's C, number 2. Roman numeral 2C. And those living by faith in the promise of God could see behind the sacrifices to the reality. Peter writes in 1 Peter chapter 1, he says, concerning this salvation, the prophets who spoke of the grace that was to come to you searched intently and with the greatest care, trying to find out the time and circumstances to which the Spirit of Christ in them was pointing. They could see down through history. Now, if you'll turn with me to the 53rd chapter of Isaiah, the most brilliant and clear portrayal of the meaning of sacrifice, the meaning of the cross, I think, in the entire Bible, is written by the prophet Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 53. And it's written in the midst of despair, of a situation that looks hopeless. Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. Her people are going to be taken into captivity. Her people are going to see all the things they trusted in shambles. They're going to think that their God has been defeated, that He does not have the power to deliver and save. And Babylonian influences, cultural influences, and religious influences are going to start encroaching on their lives while they're in captivity, and they're going to begin to think, well, why not, you know? Why not change gods? Why not change the focus and center of my life? I mean, what good has it done me to trust in God? Look at what's happened. And into that apathy and indifference, Isaiah's got to interject some hope. He's got to show them how the glory of the Lord in chapter 40 is going to be revealed to all flesh. But how is he going to go about doing that? How will the God, the maker of and creator of all in the earth, how will he show himself? How will he redeem people and bring his people back to himself? And I just imagine the night. And again, I'm just conjecturing because I can imagine it was a night. The night Isaiah was struggling with this question. God said, I'm going to bring you my glory. I'm going to redeem you. I'm going to level the mountains and fill the valleys. Bring my people back to me. And Isaiah's saying, how? How are you going to do that? And then, the night the Spirit of God gives him that vision, he can't sleep. He's wide awake and he gets up and his pen starts to write. And you know the first thing he says? Who has believed our message? Who's going to believe the way he's going to do this? Who's going to believe this? That the arm of the Lord is going to be revealed through this? This has to be inspired by God. Because it would be so contrary to Isaiah's thinking, so contrary to the thinking of all flesh and of all mankind. But he arises and he writes, chapter 3. And John in chapter 12, 41, Isaiah wrote this because he saw Jesus before and spoke about him. Now let's look at the text of chapter 53. Who is speaking here? I believe that if you look at verse 1, who has believed our message and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? And in verse 2b, he had no beauty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. Who's the we? Who's the us? I think it's those who heard but just could not believe. I think it was those who at one time, Isaiah says, didn't believe for certain reasons, but now looking back, they've come to understand and see. They've confessed their misunderstanding and their ignorance. All the verbs from 1 through 9 are in past tense, which indicate that whoever this is, is looking back on the suffering of Jesus and said, believe God did this. Here we were in a position where we saw it, we saw it, we just didn't. We didn't value it. We ignored it. We esteemed Him not. But now we've come to see. And then, Roman numeral 3a, the identity of the speaker are those who have heard but could not believe. The we, the us there. Under b, verses 1 through 3 of chapter 53, they confess their judgment and their lack of appreciation. Who has believed it? Few? None? Hardly? Look at the crowd that was around the cross when it was finished. Or at least they thought it was finished. How many were there? How many had faith? How many could see what God was doing? Who's believed it? And to whom of the arm, the arm of the Lord, who's been built after 51:10 as the arm of the Lord there is His power to save. It's His power to save. Who's got the God to go this, save us and redeem us? And then they go into why they have not believed. He grew up before Him like a tender shoot and like a root out of dry ground. That's how He came. Came in a manger in a lowly, despised town called Bethlehem. Grew up with a lower middle class or middle class family as a carpenter. Tender shoot. The picture there is a horticultural term. It's this little shoot growing out of a trunk of a tree or out of a branch, being nourished by God. Nobody noticed those first 30 years except God. Very unimpressive. Very hidden in our nature. We've got one incident out of those first 30 years that we know anything about. It's really unimpressive. Especially if it's going to be the arm of the Lord, Creator of all that is, to save. And so He comes out like a tender shoot and like a root out of dry ground. I think there's an analogy there too. What kind of atmosphere did He grow up in? Corrupt. An adulterous generation, Jesus called it. A generation of people that He described down in verse 6 as each of them going His own way. Religious, sure, but not listening to God. Dry, arid soil. Not too nourishing for a king. And then He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to Him. Nothing in His appearance that we should desire Him. That's what belief in this society is based on. Attraction. Belief is based on desire. And it's still true in our society. If it doesn't have a lot of pomp playing around it, if it doesn't show a lot of power and prestige and physical beauty, we discount it. We overlook it. We underestimate it. We miss it. That's exactly what the people did. He was despised and rejected by man, a man familiar with suffering. Like one from men, from whom men hide their faces, He was despised, and we esteemed Him not. Didn't appreciate it the time it was here. Took us time to wake up, see what was really there. And when he came, you know, when he stepped out at age 30, he didn't step out for power and prestige. What he stepped out for, Isaiah says, was to be identified with suffering. Always had sick people around him. They flocked to him. Those who were grieved, those who were stricken with sorrow, those who were filled with remorse, spiritual remorse for their own lives and the way they'd lived. The underdog, the tax collector, he was always with them and associating with them. People in need, crying out to him, and he was there. He was available to them. And the leaders didn't like that. This is not good for your image, Jesus. What are you doing around those people all the time? And boy, I tell you, whenever they attack one of those people to destroy them, like the woman that's caught in adultery, he'd just stand up right between them and he says, now to get to her, you're going to have to go through me. You're going to have to take me too. You're going to take her. He was their advocate, their defender. Because he took upon himself their sickness and their infirmities. He carried that on himself. Took it into himself and made it his own. Hurt with them. Cried with them. And he said because of that, we didn't have any esteem for him. We hid our face from him. We shunned him. He was nothing. He was insignificant. Then in verse 4, they wake up. Under your outline number C, in sharp contrast to their pitiful misunderstanding, they now see the true reason for the servant's suffering. Here's the reason he suffered. They wake up. Surely. And that just basically means, let me the truth of the matter. Surely. Here's the truth of the matter. Surely he took up. You want to underline that or circle it. He took up and carried that one too. Carried our sorrows. Those verbs are used throughout the Old Testament many times. Exodus 28, verse 43. Leviticus 17, verse 6. It's used several times in the book. It takes time to look for. To assume the burden of. And the picture there is that he is not only identifying with suffering and he's participating in suffering, but he's taking the consequences of people's suffering. The consequences of their sin and their failure. He's taking upon them. He's carrying it away from them. Moving it from them. As far as the east is from the west, so far has he carried, he's moved our transgressions from us, the psalmist said in 103. And yet, in verse 4b, we considered him stricken by God. We thought he was getting what he deserved when he hung there as a felon, as a criminal between two thieves. I mean, after all, he asked for this. After all, he was always identifying with the wrong people. After all, he always getting himself into trouble. He just didn't look successful. So we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him and afflicted, cursed by God. Someone that God himself, not only us, but God himself would want nothing to do with. Then they come back again, but, and here's an amplification of what they saw, but he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Two of the strongest terms in the Hebrew language. Pierced, crushed, violence was done to him. And it was in our place, in our stead. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. Paul said in Romans 3 and verse 25 that God presented him as a sacrifice of atonement because he had left the sins committed beforehand, because in his forbearance he had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished. Punishment. Most people in this auditorium today are serious about their lives. Most people in this auditorium today, I would say, take sin seriously. They don't want a cheap forgiveness. They don't want a forgiveness to just say, oh, well, boys will be boys. Let's just whitewash the whole thing. They want to know that the sin has been punished. They want to know that the penalty has been paid. Is there any penalty? I mean, is this just me getting off scot-free? Is God just excuse sin? No, sin has been punished. The penalty has been paid. Forgiveness is not cheap. It cost. It cost the pain and the heartache of the one who is forgiving because they have been hurt and because they see the hurt of others. The punishment that brought us peace was upon Him. I never will forget a friend of mine who's a preacher. He said he was typing this scripture out one day and he missed the H and hit the J. His first name is Jim. And it says the punishment that brought us peace was upon Jim. And he hit the J and he went on down, typed the next line, and he glanced up and he read that and he said, and he just started to tremble, and then the tears started to just flow down his cheeks. And then verse 6, we all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way. He's the only one who wasn't living like that. He hadn't turned to his own way. He wasn't living for himself. He came in the world to live for others, to bring others to God. But each of us had turned to his own way. Each of us, like Adam and Eve, had taken, I can decide what's right and wrong. This is right and this is wrong. I'll do what I want to. Like sheep, rebellious. Like sheep, unaware. Like sheep, foolish. Like sheep, gone astray. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. And under D in your outline, or C number one, I'm getting carried away and I've lost my place in my outline. C number one, verse 5 reveals their thinking at the very time of the crucifixion. And number two, each of us turn to his own way. Now this group of people are going to start talking about his innocence. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was like a lamb to the slaughter, as a sheep before his shearers is silent, so he didn't open his mouth. He's not a whipped puppy. That's not the picture of a whipped puppy. Like some dog that you've disciplined, this guy's tail between his legs, he's just whimpering. That's a symbol of strength, love. Down in verse 9b, he done no violence and no deceit was found in his mouth. That's what Peter marveled at on the cross when he quotes the same passage in 1 Peter chapter 2. He says, they hurled their insults at him and he wouldn't retaliate. When he was suffering, he didn't threaten with vengeance and punishment and judgment of God. He just took it, kept silent. And so under your outline D, the purity of his heart and his life was shown by the use of his tongue. You know what? You want to know what's in your heart? You want to know what's in my heart? Put me under pressure and watch me is how I use my tongue. Watch what I say. Listen to what I say when I'm under pressure, when I'm being abused, when I'm afflicted, when I'm suffering. That'll tell you what's in my heart. And here's the purity of his life, the strength of his character. He would not retaliate. He took all that evil could throw at him that day and would not abuse people with his tongue and with his language. He would not retaliate. Satan tried every way he could. He bruised his heel. He bruised him. He crushed him. But he couldn't get him to sin. And when Jesus breathed his last and bowed his head and died, in Handel's Messiah, both in the Garden of Gethsemane and there at that point, there's a little hallelujah that goes up. And there's a little hallelujah here as he closes this, beginning in verse 10. Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. The psalmist said in Psalm 76 and verse 10, I will make even the wrath of man praise me. The wrath of man ends up serving the purpose of God. They meant it for evil. God meant it for good. And that's in your outline on E. This man was handed over to you by the express purpose and foreknowledge of God, Peter says in Acts 2 and verse 23. They did what your power and will had decided beforehand should happen, Peter told them in Acts 4, verse 28. This was God's will. His will was being done. And yet nobody saw it. Nobody saw it. And though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering, he shall see his offspring and prolong his days. There's the resurrection. And the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. After the suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. And if you've got an NIV, that footnote down at the bottom that says he will see the result of the suffering of his soul and be satisfied. Jesus could see what this would bring. He could see the life that this would give to people who would believe it. The sons that would be produced from it. The sons and daughters of God. And he could see that his mission was going to be accomplished because God raised him from the dead. Under E number 1, God's attitude toward sinners is not the result of the cross, it's the cause of the cross. Jesus was trying to change God's attitude toward you and me. He was trying to demonstrate it. God so loved the world that he gave his only Son. Jesus didn't come so God could love the world. He came because God did love the world. And his life demonstrated that. I don't know how the cross is communicated to you, but to me it's always been through people. The first lesson I learned was from an old woman whose hair I made gray because of all my disobedience and transgression. It was my mother. And I was a junior in high school. I looked back down. Finally she got up, went back into her bedroom, closed the door, and I could just hear her sobbing. And you could have beat me with a horse whip. Wouldn't hurt any worse than that. And all that stuff that I'd been doing just started rushing up to my consciousness. And I began to feel my guilt, bear my shame, my disgrace. 2 days later, I'd even forgotten momentarily that it was my birthday. And when I came in from school that afternoon, she had cooked my favorite cake and bought me a new pair of cufflinks that I'd wanted. Now, why did she suffer? Did she ever say to me, Ben, how could you do this to your mother? That's not love. That's just exalted self-pity. The person she was suffering for was me, when I wouldn't suffer for myself. When I was too callous and insensitive and disregarded, she took on herself my iniquities and she bore the pain that I caused. And through that old woman, I was on my road to understanding the cross of Jesus Christ. And it's through a lot of people like that that I've understand what it means that God loved me and took my sin upon Himself. I will never know the real cost that it took Him to reach me and to love me and to get me to wake up, get me to turn, because I'm a sheep going my own way. And so often I still do that. But I'll tell you one thing right now. I've got hope for my life, because it looked awful bleak and awful grim that day in the Garden of Eden when Adam and Eve sinned. It looked awfully grim and horrible that day when Isaiah sat down to pen those words of promise. And it looked pretty bad that night I sat on the couch before the mother who loved me so much. And the blackest, grimmest day, the most unspeakable disaster and tragedy in history, looked like the cross of Jesus Christ. But if God can take something like that, bring out of it the event of glory and majesty, power that He did, then He can take any mess in your life, any sin, no matter how deep, any pain, any grief, and bring life to it. But the point is, who is going to believe the message? And to whom will the arm of the Lord be revealed? While we stand and sing.